steal the commons, and they thieve from the people their land, the water, the knowledge, the industry, everything. It's thieved by actually a state system which is run by hierarchical elites. So there are perennial powers that remain in power, whether they're economic or otherwise. These money lenders in the background stay in power, whether you like it or not, whether you want to go to the Rothschild syndicates or whether you want to go to the Rockefellers. The reality is that these are the permanent power people. The presidents are just like going through a revolving door. They come and go. They cannot come into power unless these powerful forces allow them to. So for me, the plutocrats, basically, or the kleptocrats, actually are the ones who really dictate and run the show. There's a mechanism which looks like it's a sort of a democracy, but it's a fake democracy, because the people are too stupid politically to be able to really make valid choices, because they're not educated in politics. And I'm not being facetious about it. The American public, and even the British public, if you ask most of them about economic policies or about foreign countries, even to place where foreign countries are, they would not have a clue. So if you don't even know the first thing about geopolitics or politics or about the world, and you don't know about the economy and how your dollar is linked petrol, or how your economic kind of mechanism works, then obviously I'm entitled to call that person politically and economically illiterate. And that goes for the overwhelming majority of the American voting public. This illiterate political economic class effectively voting whoever the Zionist-controlled media, and that's again, we'll go and look at the records, I'm not going to give everything to everybody, but you can easily go and look at who are the media moguls, five or six of them, all Zionist-linked, all moneylender-linked, all structural elite-linked characters basically run the media, and the media, ultimately, wherever it puts its kind of weight, will generally win the day for that particular candidate. That's the way it works here. This is how everything is controlled. I mean, I was banned off Facebook today for putting up posts about Abai Soleimani. And of course, Facebook is just another part of that social media, just as Twitter and all the rest of it, because the algorithms are controlled by the same mechanism. So what I'm alluding to is Donald Trump has been put in power by a set of plutocrats, a moneylender class. They are the ones who thieve the commons of most of the nations, including America, including Britain. They are the ones who also implement something very subtle, and this is something Islam and the Islamic Republic of Iran will resonate with, because they are the ones who have set up a moneylending system based on usury. Usury is the mechanism by which they control society, and they threaten leaders, and they threaten nations. Debt is what Britain has. Debt is what America has, to the tune of trillions. These are the richest countries in the world, yet they're in debt. Who are they in debt to? Big question. Who are they in debt to? Who is so powerful and so large that they can carry the debt of America, and they can keep the debt of Britain and such powerful economic nations? Well, it's a question that, again, one has to explore. I would hazard argue that it's the structural elite. It's those money lenders who basically decide that Britain is an offshore tax haven where, you know, brigands and robbers and plutocrats and such like people can hide their money, can wash their money through dirty laundry, and can run fake wars which will continue to keep everybody fighting each other. I think that's the logic, that the flux we're seeing in the world, the pawns that are being driven around, of which America is the biggest pawn, it is their pawn in chief, is being used to create chaos, to create sort of fear, to create demoralization, to make a religion fight religion, to make state fight state, to sell weapons and arms, to keep the economy rolling, to keep people deluded. There's an entire fascinating system which is in place, which revolves around manipulation of the public and getting everybody to vote. And it's really, I think, a power trip for these people who are there. And they can be discernibly, if you like, found if you really want to. But the trouble is, people haven't got the political and economic ability. They don't even have the critical thinking or the critical questioning and inquiry taught to them in schools here. So actually, they don't have the ability to start asking questions to that level. They're just doing 9 to 5, 9 to 8, 9 to 9 jobs on a hamster wheel, and they follow whatever mainstream media dictates to them. If they say Jeremy Corbyn is a Jew hater or an anti-Semite, then the majority of the public here who can't be bothered to find out will say, yes, Jeremy Corbyn's a Jew hater, even though the guy's probably been the biggest anti-racist in Britain for God knows how long. So to be honest with you, we're dealing with a very sophisticated method of manipulation and control of the masses. Donald Trump is not outside of that control mechanism. And whatever he's doing now with the Islamic Republic of Iran, or the actions that are being carried out, he's doing it on the orders of somebody higher than certainly I think the American state itself.
Okay, say that, boss. Stay with me. We have with us Tony Gosling joining us, the investigative journalist out of the British city of Bristol. Tony, welcome. I have to ask you this same question that I asked, say that, boss. And it's regarding this letter that the United States has sent to Iraq. We've now got a top US general saying that the letter, an official letter sent to Baghdad, about regarding withdrawing US forces from Iraq was genuine, quote, I'm quoting here, the letter was genuine but was sent by mistake. Tony, what do you mean? I mean, this makes you laugh if it doesn't make you cry.
Okay, so what's the contents of the letter? Are we talking about the one where the Americans are saying that we want paying for the air bases that we've built?
So this is a letter by that's been just tonight over the past hour or so.
All right.
That was seen by the Reuters news agency as well as AFP news agency. It's an official letter from the United States to Iraq saying that the US will be pulling its troops out of Iraq.
Well, I would suggest that's actually...
Reuters said this was authentic.
Yeah.
The United States now saying it is indeed authentic, yet Mark Esper says it was sent by mistake. The top US general is now saying it was genuine, but again, sent by mistake. Kind of wraps up US foreign policy in a way.
Well, it does show that there is a disconnect and chaos going on at the Pentagon, and particularly with the US forces. It seems, I would suggest actually a very sensible thing for the US to do right now. The last thing that the American public and the American and actually the Trump administration really want to happen is to see a lot of Americans come back in body bags. That is one of the serious possible repercussions of what the Americans have done with this drone killing of Qasem Soleimani. And we remember, anyone that can remember back to the horrific attack on the American Marines base in Lebanon a few decades ago will know that the Americans are vulnerable in the Middle East. They are 6,000 miles away from home. It's very, very difficult to supply these soldiers at such a distance. They rely on other states such as Turkey, Germany, Ireland. Shannon Airport in Ireland is used a lot, but a lot of Irish people don't even know that, to supply and resupply and to replace troops in the Middle East. They're very vulnerable there. And I think there's quite a lot of senior officers in the US forces who will be scratching their heads, wondering what Donald Trump and his friends hope to achieve by assassinating Qasem Soleimani, because it's just made their life far, far more dangerous and far more difficult over in the Middle East, and put many, many lives of US troops at risk. Interesting, though, I think on the news here tonight to hear that there are very few British troops still in Iraq, and that they're considering bringing them back soon as well, because apparently they're not really doing much anymore, and the last thing they want is for the British to suffer some sort of reprisal for this wanton act of murder, assassination, which seems to have been incredibly misguided. The most, I mean, it's very difficult to figure out what the strategy is from the US side. What do they hope to achieve other than just to enrage countries and people around the world against the US government, the US military and the US plans in the Middle East? The most sensible suggestion I've heard so far is that this is an attempt to divert from Trump's own impeachment proceedings. So this is what often happens. It happened before, several years ago, with Bill Clinton. There were attacks on the Middle East in order to divert from the impeachment proceedings against Clinton.
A poor connection there with Tony. We'll try and re-establish that line. Just to understand Tony's points of views better. Marcel, if I can return to you, and regarding the mourning ceremonies, the funeral.
One of the most celebrated generals, certainly not the most senior one, but he was the most high profile. And I think the message that has gone back to the Americans is at every stage of the way, their administration has lied to them. First of all, the sympathies of the Iranian public are with their administration, with the policies, indeed, that on foreign soil, which General Soleimani was one of the key components of and the architects of, because they know that ultimately what General Soleimani was helping was not only helping those oppressed within Syria or within Yemen or within Iraq, which undoubtedly he was, and beyond Palestine. Need I mention Palestine itself, and Lebanon, of course, has been there for a long time. That's just some of the arenas in which General Soleimani's influence, his advice, his support, his military tactical excellence and brilliance has shone. And what it's done is effectively given the Islamic Republic of Iran lots of allies, lots of friends amongst the oppressed, not amongst the ruling classes, not amongst the oppressors who run most of those countries or have been violating the kind of the economies of those countries, whether it's Yemen or whether it's Syria. And it's not about them, it's about the oppressed within those communities. And it was about stopping Daesh. Of course, his epitaph is really ultimately that he is the man who can be credited ultimately with the conquest and the vanquishing of ISIS, Daesh, and Zionist American, if you like, efforts to implement the Hinnon plan, which Israel is well known to want to do, which is that Israel must either have proxies and satellites or themselves be in control of land from Egypt right up to the Nile to the Euphrates. This is a commonly known strategy. So General Qasem Soleimani has thwarted the Hinnon plan effectively. He's stopped them in their tracks. He stopped the Americans, the Zionists, the Israelis, and the Takfiri Wahhabist cancer in its tracks. And of course, they are the only ones who show any jubilation, but they shouldn't dance too much, because what they've seen now is that what they've done is if there was any doubt, they've unified that doubt. They've unified the people of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and they made it clear that the Americans are an evil administration, an evil system. The people themselves, fine. The American people are naive. I don't put it down to them. But the leadership is consistently, as a system, it is evil beyond all words that can be expressed. They get up in the morning with their suits, with their coffee, planning how they're going to kill more Yemeni children, five-year-old, three-year-old kids, how they're going to spread cholera in that country, how they're going to bomb Gazans and keep them in control. They get up in the morning with their suits and their cups of coffee, and they prepare to see how they can destroy the Islamic Republic, how they can get rid of legitimate democratically elected governments in Iran, in Iraq, anywhere that doesn't suit them. They get up every morning trying to see how they can rape the resources of all of these nations. This is what General Soleimani has been all about. He has been there to stop that tyranny which has been going on. He has been the figurehead, the front man. And it's interesting how he had no limelight until a couple of years ago. He started coming up on the radar, and it's almost as if the Islamic Republic of Iran was saying thank you, Rebel was saying thank you to him for the services he'd rendered behind the scenes. And he became ultimately the hero, the legend that he is now. He's just a hero. He's a legend and a martyr, a legend which is based on his martyrdom. And he was finally given the even more dangerous job, which was that he should come into the public as the face of the resistance axis. And the resistance axis is a far more threatening thing, because it's neither Shia, it's not Sunni, it's not Iraqi, it's not Iranian, it's not Yemeni. It's an alliance, a loose alliance of people who have been suffering for decades under the yoke of Zionist imperialism, and they've risen up. And actually, Imam Khomeini, let's not forget, when he talked about exporting the revolution, well, exporting the revolution of morality, the revolution of divine justice, exporting the revolution of ideas that would tackle tyranny and oppression, you know, Ayatollah Khomeini would be smiling with Soleimani right now, because they will be together, and he will have fulfilled all of the dreams and the direction, as has ever, as has Ayatollah Khamenei. And it's the founder of the revolution, the Islamic revolution that started in Iran. And now what we're seeing is that revolution is blossoming. It's in its own way, in its own shape, in its own form. It's beginning to flower, beginning to spread. This is the power of Iman. It's the power of faith in divine justice. And these people, the Iranians who turned out today, they are the people of Imam al-Mahdi. They are the people who are waiting for the Savior most avidly. They are the people who have been said by the Prophet in his hadith that there will be a nation that will rise up and that will fulfill this prophetic dream. And the prophetic dream is for a peaceful world based on justice. Can't have peace without justice. In order to bring peace, you need a moral, just force. I say that the Iraqis, who are the custodians of the shrines, which Donald Trump today has said that he's happy to blow up, the cultural places, the spiritual places, he said today he's willing to bomb 52 of them. That could be Ghazmain, that could be in Baghdad, it could be Karbala, it could be Najaf, it could be Imam Reza's shrine. These are the things which have no value for a Dajjalic force like Trump and his entourage. And they're saying they're willing to destroy these sacred sites. And I would say that the people of Iraq, the people of Iran, are the number one custodians, because in these territories exists these holy places, these holy shrines. It is, of course, the responsibility of these Muslims to stand up and say, no, you will not do this, and we are here to prevent you. And that's exactly what is happening now. Trump is going to find out that an insurgency will rise. If he doesn't move his troops out post-haste, what will happen is that those forces that have been giving the Americans a little bit of a benefit of the doubt, because they wanted to compromise with the Kurds and compromise with arguably some of the Sunni tribesmen or the Baathists, everybody wanted to keep a hunky-dory relationship in Iraq. Well, I think that those rules are out the window. All the rules have gone. It's going to be a far more serious game even in Iraq. I don't think Kataib Hezbollah, for instance, are going to tolerate Iraqi MPs going around cutting deals with Americans in the background over oil and siphoning off the oil. None of these PMU forces are going to tolerate the nonsense that's gone on in some circles within those governments. And I think the Iranian people and the Iraqi people over the last 2 or 3 days have demonstrated that they are people of love, they are people of emotion, they are people of justice, and they are people who are attached to a far bigger divine purpose and cause. And Donald Trump, who has the Christian Zionists, the Jewish Zionists, and the Muslim Zionists, who all believe in a divine purpose as well. They believe the divine purpose is to maintain Israel and make sure that Zionists carry on occupying the Middle East, not just Palestine. Well, these are two forces that can never compromise. You know, you can't have falsehood with truth. And the fact of the matter is that what you've got is a tyrannical Christian Zionism, Judaic Zionism, and even an Arab Muslim Zionism in the form of Saudi Arabia. Don't forget, this is the axis. Can you really see the Islamic Republic of Iran with its ideals, with its principles, with its Islamic revolutionary concepts? Do you think there's any real chance of there being a rapprochement with these people unless they stop their tyranny and actually give back the land of Palestine to the people who are its rightful owners, unless they move out of Iraq, give the land back to the rightful owners, unless they stop trying to interfere with the internal politics of the Muslim world just for oil and just for the money lenders and the Zionist interests. There will be no peace for Americans, and they will see body bags drift back to their loved ones, and they're not going to like it.
Okay, now the Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdelmehdi is saying Baghdad is doing all it can to prevent the Iraq and possibly the entire region from descending into war with the United States. Tony is back with us, Tony Gosling. We're going to get his reaction to today's funeral ceremonies that were held for General Soleimani. Dear viewers, stay with us. Sayyid Abbas, Masoud Abbas, stay with us. Tony, stay with us. We're going to take a short look at a short package from the Russian capital, Moscow, and we'll be right back.
A memorial service was held at the Iranian embassy in Moscow on Sunday for top Iranian commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The Iranian general, who was the head of Iran's IRGC Quds Force, along with Abu Mahdi al-Muhandas, the second in command of Iraq's popular mobilization units, was killed in U.S. airstrikes in the Iraqi capital Baghdad on Friday. People who attended the memorial service paid their respects to General Soleimani and condemned the U.S. attack as a violation of international law. Representatives of the Association of Iranian Students in Moscow were also in attendance.
Our enemies think that because they killed Qasem Soleimani, his past will be forgotten. They don't know that his path, his thoughts, and his culture taught him how to become a hero, how to become great. Today, the whole world is indignant because the worst people killed one of the best people. Watch the news today, and everywhere will be his name and the name of his country.
It was impossible not to come to the Iranian embassy and express condolences over the murder of the heroic man Qasem Soleimani. He was not just a military man, but a man doing his duty. He was a very good-natured person living in a very difficult time. His murder is not just a violation of international law, as Russian diplomats and military officials have said. This is a war crime.
Meanwhile, at the residence of the ambassador in Moscow, the same day, people of different nationalities gathered to honor the memory of the hero with a prayer. The new Iranian ambassador to Russia praised Soleimani's role in countering terrorism and coordinating activities between Iran and Russia in Syria against terrorist groups.
It is time that peace-loving people, international, regional, and world organizations and institutions parted ways with this law-breaking terrorist regime and put an end to warmongering U.S. policies and actions.
Iran has vowed to seek revenge on the United States for what the Iranian foreign minister has described as an act of state terrorism and a violation of Iraq's sovereignty.
Russia has slammed the U.S. assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, an adventurous step that will increase tensions throughout the region. It says the killing of a representative of a government of a sovereign state is completely devoid of any legal basis. Marina Kartunova, Press TV, Moscow.
To our viewers, we are you're participating now in rolling coverage we have going on here at Press TV, going on 4 days since the assassination of Iran's Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and second in command of the popular mobilization units of the Iraqi armed forces, Al-Muhandis, killed by U.S. drone strike just outside Baghdad International Airport last Friday morning. And joining us for this extended conversation is Tony Gosling, investigative journalist out of Bristol, and Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, political commentator, joining us from London. Hello, gentlemen. We just wrapped up with Wassam, and it's Dan Arya here. I want to say hello to both of you. I guess, Tony, I heard Sayyid was finishing off before we went out to break, so I'm swinging back with you. Tony, go ahead, bud.
Well, I think one of the most incredible things about this is it shows just how much disarray the United States policy strategists are. First of all, there is really no strategy here. There is no thinking beyond the act of this murder itself. So it's really just driven by hatred towards a specific individual for whatever reason. It's also almost like teenage children with their killing toys, these drones. Incidentally, there has been evidence published that the British are involved in the whole chain of command whereby people are being killed by drones from everywhere from Yemen to Afghanistan. We've got RAF Croughton and RAF Menwith Hill, which are actually United States Air Force bases, but they are bases where the Americans in Britain have their National Security Agency, National Reconnaissance Agency, and US Air Force. And even though it says Royal Air Force, the British Air Force on the door, once you go inside, it's just Americans everywhere. And these bases are being used, according to some journalists around the world. Glenn Greenwald, I think, is one of them, who did an investigation into this, these are part and parcel of an international network. Of course, the purpose of this is interesting because the Americans want the British to be involved. Another key site in the drone wars is Ramstein, the air base in Germany. So it's almost as if the Americans are trying to make sure that the Americans and the British are blooded in these killings so that they are implicated, because some of the activities to do with the targeting of the drones, etc., and the actual control of the drones from afar is taking place on German soil and on British soil. Which is why I think we've seen a rather cool response from the British about this attack. So they're doing everything they can in London to not to swing on one side or the other, to sit on the fence. One thing I can tell you is that the coverage here in the UK has been very condemnatory of it. So what's happening is slowly the US is actually alienating some of its key allies. And Britain is a key ally here. The establishment in Britain are certainly not patting Donald Trump on the back for this act. They are wondering, scratching their heads and wondering exactly what the strategy is. And of course, it does look as if the strategy is no strategy. Look at, for example, at this incredible swerving from one side to another of the American policy over the destruction of cultural sites. We saw a press conference in Washington today, the president's press spokespeople denying that he had even said that cultural sites were being targeted. Journalists were pointing out, well, this is a war crime to do this. Why is the president doing this? And so the press spokesperson then comes on again and says, oh, well, no, you've misunderstood. Trump didn't mean that at all. And then what happens is Trump gives an on-the-record briefing to journalists directly himself, saying that he did mean it. So there is one policy coming out of one side of the mouth, another policy coming out of the other side of the mouth. Complete disarray. And, of course, that really smacks of no policy. And for anybody that's considering whether or not the United States is going to be a good ally into the future, and that, of course, will be all of the main European countries, the Germans, the French, the British, and, of course, other countries around the world, are just wondering whether maybe it's the best thing to do is to distance themselves from US policy. Certainly that's what we're seeing here being suggested, that British troops may possibly be pulled out of Iraq because they are now not really serving any useful purpose there anyway. And the last thing they want is for them to just be targeted as part of the retaliation for this really reckless war crime by the United States. So the intelligence also has still not been revealed. Donald Trump said on the very first day that he had caught him in the act, that he had received intelligence that Soleimani was involved in plotting to kill Americans. And many journalists from all around the world, including from the United States, have been asking, what is this intelligence? Show us this intelligence. And nothing whatsoever has been produced. Nothing. And they're saying, oh, well, we can't reveal it. Well, I think they better reveal it, because the suspicion around the world is that they're just making this up as they go along. And of course, we know that they've got this obsession with regime change, the regime changes that we've seen in Libya. I say they, but of course, the British were involved and the French were involved in that as well. And also the failed, now it looks like, attempt to have a regime change in Syria with this enormous Daesh ISIS mercenary army that was flooding in from NATO allies Turkey in order to, as a proxy army, to invade Syria. That now looks as if with Qasem Soleimani on the ground and Putin's Russian air force in the air, that has now been defeated. So that's a great victory for world peace. It's also, by the way, a victory for the United Nations Security Council, because that is an institution which is really starting to lose its teeth. And so what's happened is one of the members of the UN Security Council, the Russians in this case, have stepped in really to do the UN's job for it, because, you know, what with the US vetoes on any kind of sensible attempts to bring peace to the Middle East, particularly through the Israeli resolutions relating to the expansionist and the racist tactics of the Israelis over the decades, the Americans veto that every time. But what we've seen with the Russian intervention in Syria is that at least one member of the UN Security Council is prepared to act, and act decisively, to stop these kind of regime change actions. Now, I mean, regime change trips off the tongue, doesn't it? We quite often hear about it. Yes, we want to see regime change in Venezuela, Bolivia, or wherever it happens to be. But let me just remind everybody that this is totally illegal under international law. This is a war crime to try and change a country's leader by toppling a leader by military means or by whatever means is illegal. And the Americans seem to be trying to do this as if it's going out of fashion. The other thing I think to say is I think we have to look at what the Americans are doing with this provocation quite clearly. The attempt here is to try and provoke a reaction from Iran. So in a way, maybe the most wise reaction from Iran will be no reaction, because the Americans are trying to evoke a reaction. And let's face it, the actual policy that Soleimani has been implementing in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere is not going to change. So it's not all hinging on the one individual. There's going to be, I mean, in fact, I believe his deputy has already replaced him. And the policy will continue. The same policies will continue. The same sorts of negotiations. Nothing is actually really going to change, except, of course, you know, obviously for the family and for those in Iran who are mourning the death of Qasem Soleimani, the policies will continue in a very similar fashion. So I find it very difficult to understand what the United States is doing here.
And some interesting points there, Tony. I'm going to swing over to Sid. Now, Sid, it's funny that Tony should mention the U.S.'s regime change policy. With the war machine that the U.S. is, can a multi-trillion dollar mega, you know, war machine that the U.S. is survive without a regime change policy the way it's had for centuries and decades, and the perpetuation of chaos that it generates throughout the world?
No, I think that whatever system is in place, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, there's a debt. America has a debt service. The Chinese carry some of that debt currently. I mean, I'm not an economic expert, but all I understand is that this debt is there, and when they go to war, that debt rises, and the arms dealers like Raytheon and Lockheed and all these transnational corporations, again, run by shadowy figures in the background, they're the ones who profit. So, you know, America has not really profited from those wars. There's an underclass in America which testifies to the fact that American wealth isn't really necessarily serving all of the American people. But I'm with you on that, but I'd like to go back to what Mr. Gosling was saying earlier, and I agree with him, but to put some flesh on the bone of what he was hinting at, there was a question that was raised as to General Qasem Soleimani and the circumstances of his death. Let's get this clear. Prime Minister Adil Abdul Mehdi has now revealed, and this is really huge, because what he's revealed is that Qasem Soleimani was coming to Iraq on his invitation, and the invitation was requested by the Americans. The U.S. administration had contacted Adil Abdul Mehdi and asked him to arrange talks between Iran and the Americans. So the Iraqi prime minister went ahead. So what was going on was an official diplomatic mission. General Qasem Soleimani was on an official diplomatic mission requested by who? Donald Trump's administration. So they stab him in the back, knowing that he's coming on this. So this sounds like it's premeditated to me. They've lured in somebody knowing what they're going to do something, to kill him effectively and to assassinate. And they backstab the Prime Minister of Iraq as well. So, you know, basically there is no ambiguity. What they've done is not some sort of act of self-defense, because what their argument in the American media and the administration has been is that we've killed General Soleimani because he was planning to lead attacks against our troops in the Middle East. Well, what nonsense! What Prime Minister Abdelmehdi has revealed totally shatters that lie, and it basically means they've syndicated the assassination of a diplomat, effectively, and that is an act of war under any circumstances. And I believe that's what's actually happened is a declaration of war on Iran-Iraq. It's up to the Iranians and the Iraqis how they, if you like, how seriously they take that. I think they're taking it very, very seriously. I would probably agree that the Islamic Republic of Iran won't respond in the way that America wants them to respond, because this war is being pushed for by, as I said, the Israeli lobby and the oil lobby, if anything. It's the oil lobbies need the oil of Iraq. They can't have an Iraqi government which is veering towards Iran and too much independence, and they're worried about that. The Israelis are worried about Iraqi unity with Iran and Syria, because it creates an entire swathe of land running from Iran right down to the borders of Israel in Lebanon and with Hamas and in Palestine. And they see that as a huge threat. So let's call out the elephant in the room. This isn't really about America and its interests alone. In fact, it's far more about the American surrogate of Israel. Okay, basically, Israel needs this war. Israel needs the balkanization. Israel needs Iran brought to its knees. Israel needs to stop Iran having a nuclear capacity of any kind, because Israel is the primary, destroyer of peace in the Middle East. Alongside them is the Saudi Arabians, who have profited and benefited from the patronage of the Americans and the Israelis covertly, and in return they've been giving them payments of trillions. $3 trillion of Saudi Arabian money is locked in real estate alone. That's what we know of in American real estate. Don't talk about Swiss banks and all the other hidden tax havens where they throw that cash, the people's wealth. But suffice to say, this axis of Saudi Arabia, America, and Israel is the fundamental problem in the Middle East. America has no business there other than economic business. So, and there's no point in pleading to the Americans that, oh, you need to leave on the basis of some sort of moral grounds, because they don't believe in morality. They believe in economics. So the economics tells them, well, you need to rape the resources of the Middle East, so that's why they will stay there. But for the life of me, I cannot understand why they don't bring in the economics question when it comes to Israel. There is no economic benefit in keeping Israel on their post. In fact, they give something like $3.5 billion a year just for, I think, their upkeep and whatnot. So Israel is leeching off Americans, while poor Americans are dying on the streets without health care, without even a formal national health care system they can rely on properly. And the Israelis are swimming around in American dollars, having a good time. But effectively, it's Israel who is, I think, wanting this war. They know their medium and long-term survival is impossible in a Middle East where the Islamic Republic of Iran or the people of Palestine or the Lebanese or those around them become equally as powerful, if not more. And I think that they're doing everything they can to disrupt it, and the Americans are obliging.
Sayed should mention this. I want to get this out to you. This came out from a source about 9 hours ago, that according to Abdelmehdi, the Iraqi premier, he planned to meet... First, let me say, he said when he addressed the country's parliament that Trump's justification for killing General Soleimani was exposed as a cynical lie. According to Mehdi, he had planned to meet Soleimani the morning the general was killed to discuss a diplomatic rapprochement which Iraq was brokering between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Abdelmehdi said that Trump personally thanked him for the efforts even as he was planning to carry out the assassination on Soleimani, thus creating the impression that the Iranian general was safe to travel to Baghdad. And here's a quote from the Iraqi prime minister saying that, "I was supposed to meet Soleimani in the morning, the day he was killed, he came to deliver me a message from Iran, responding to the message we delivered from the Saudis to Iran. That's according to Almaty. And so this really raises a lot of questions that makes, you know, Trump's narrative on this very suspect. And to just take one step beyond that, to go one step further, why would Trump want to thwart peace efforts in the Middle East, especially between Tehran and Riyadh, at such a volatile time?
Well, look.
Precisely because the reasons I said that Israel doesn't.
You actually raised that. You raised that. I was going to put it to Tony and then come back to you.
I mean, this reminds me very much of the tactics which were used in the first Gulf War by April Glasby, the US ambassador to Kuwait, and I think it was to Iraq, wasn't it? Telling Saddam Hussein, well, you can go take Kuwait and we won't mind. They're stealing your oil, we understand. It's basically entrapment by diplomatic means. And it's very, very interesting, this whole point, which has come out in the news today, although not been on our TV news here in the UK, that Qasem Soleimani was involved in some sort of rapprochement with the Saudis. Now, the Saudis, obviously, have kind of hemmed themselves in the Middle East. They're really surrounded by trouble. This regime has been involved in the creation of ISIS, the supplying of ISIS, etc., for the Americans, because of the deals that they've been done really ever since the Bitter Lake meeting between Abdulaziz, I think it was at the time, and Truman back at the end of the Second World War, or Roosevelt. I think actually it was Roosevelt. And these deals which were done between the Saudis and the Americans have been carrying on and on and on over the years, for mostly to do with oil. The reason that the region, the oil region, is so interesting to the Americans is because they know that if they are to fight a world war, it's whoever controls the oil regions that is going to be able to keep their tanks rolling and keep their factories burning producing arms, that this is a key strategic resource to fight a world war. That's one of the reasons that they're in the Middle East. And the idea that the Saudis might start actually effectively going native, is what they call it, where there's a sort of getting on with some of their Arab neighbours, actually promoting Arabs within their own system that are more specifically entertaining ideas of negotiating and getting along more with Iraq, Syria and Iran, with people from their own region. This, of course, is like a red rag to a bull to the US and to Israel. This is the last thing in the world that they want, because their tactic, their policy, is a divide and rule policy. And if the Saudis start drifting towards becoming aligned more with the Iranians or with the Iraqis or the Syrians, this is a total disaster for them. It leaves Israel totally isolated in the Middle East, and it means potentially the death knell for the state of Israel and the Zionists, because they will have no friends anymore in that region. So these are very, very important matters, potentially, that Qasem Soleimani, if all this is true, was actually doing, and it may have been the real reason why he was assassinated, in order to stop any kind of rapprochement between the Saudi Arabian, it's a regime, it's a monarchy, it's a dictatorship, and other parts of the Middle East. But look, you have to also understand where the mentality of the Israelis are coming from. There is a very, very far-right, racist strain of Zionism. Not all the Zionists are like this, but there are many powerful ones, particularly in the Likud party, that see a whole series of events over the last few years and in the future few years. The idea is obviously originally to have a Jewish homeland in Palestine. They've got that. In 1948, the UN voted them that they could have their own country. Then they want to have Jerusalem as the capital. Well, of course, Trump has been part of that just over the last few years in moving the US embassy to Jerusalem to try and make Jerusalem the capital. Well, that was never supposed to be the case. West Jerusalem was Jewish. East Jerusalem was always intended to be controlled by the Arabs and by the Muslims. That, of course, has been violated ever since the 1967 war. Another thing is that the hardcore Zionists want Jerusalem to be only for Jews. So in other words, they want all of the other religions, but possibly even including Christians, out of Jerusalem forever. And they want it exclusively for Jews. Then they want to rebuild Solomon's Temple, which is a very bizarre idea. And it could involve demolishing the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is obviously very sacred to Islam. All of this seems to be me to be an inducement to create an enormous religious war in the Middle East. And that, it seems, is one of the missions of the far-right racist Zionists, who are so strong in the Likud party, and for example the Jewish Home Party, very strong in Israel, and then of course that would precipitate, that's what they believe, a holy war with Islam. Now this is all explained very well by the London vicar Stephen Sizer in his book Christian Zionism Roadmap to Armageddon. And I think it's what he's saying there is that this is one of the reasons that the far right in Israel is so difficult to negotiate with, because they have this really diseased vision for the future, a kind of crazed vision towards a war scenario that they believe is somehow their God-given right to ask for this war, because they're basically bringing in a brinksmanship attitude and saying to God in their own bizarre fashion, they're saying to God, now you can sort this out. We're going to create this problem and we know that God will come and help us. So there is a very bizarre and a very strange attitude within the Israelis. And that's why I think it's almost the missing link here, is that what is it that motivates these kinds of actions? One would look at me from it afar and say, who on earth would want to start a third world war? Well, I'm afraid there are big arms companies that want to do it because they believe they can make a lot of money. But then more importantly, I think there's these far-right Zionist fundamentalists that are trying to fuel this conflict and try and get it going. And those are the people, I think, that we need to be very much aware of in the West. And, of course, we see very, very little of this, even though it's a London vicar that's really, I suppose, exposed their plan. In the West, we see very, very little of it. Of course, such a war, because of the 200 Israeli nuclear weapons, which they are undeclared, they're not allowed to have, and if they did declare it, the $3 billion a year that comes from America would have to stop immediately under US law, because they're not allowed to supply undeclared countries that have undeclared nuclear weapons, then of course that sort of war could turn nuclear. So with the Israelis actually calling for war, as Netanyahu has been doing over the last few weeks and months, and with a very unstable government in Israel, I think it's entirely understandable that the Iranians will start to be looking, as people like Kim Jong-un have over in North Korea, for some kind of restoring the balance of power. Because, you know, that's what's kept us from nuclear war in the West between NATO and the old Soviet Union was, MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction. The idea that nobody can start a war because they know that both sides have got these weapons. It's an incredible policy which was developed during the Cold War. But, thank God, it's kept the peace just about the fear that no one wants to be the first person to use a nuclear weapon. And that tactic, I'm afraid, doesn't work when you have one side with nuclear weapons and one side without. It's a very, very dangerous policy. And I'm afraid the Iranians have every right because they are signatories to the non-proliferation treaty, they have every right to do peaceful nuclear power, but then they have also the right to consider what to do in response to some kind of Israeli attack. And, you know, Netanyahu, for example, has done speeches from nuclear facilities talking about, you know, how dreadful and how terrible Iran is. He's in a very inflammatory character, and it would be nice to see some proper democracy going on in Israel where you get some more moderate people, because this is the problem, is that they seem to think that a strong man is the man who is going to win an election. Someone that talks up the fear of the Arabs is going to win an election. I can tell them that if they had someone who was a bit more moderate and a little bit more balanced and started to talk about peace, you know, that they may well do very well in the elections. Although, of course, Yitzhak Rabin did try this many years ago, and he ended up not doing too well as a result. That was the end for him. But there have been some leaders in Israel over the last 30 or 40 years, particularly in the mid-1990s, who have actually done a lot to bring forward a kind of peace process. And I think actually that's at the root of the American policy, is what's going on in Israel. There's a lot of connections between the Israeli mafia in the United States, and there's a lot of sponsorship of Congress people too. So this connection between Israel and the US policy is absolutely real. And it's something that I'm sure most Americans are now aware of. They don't believe that they're doing this to save the planet, save the world, 6,000 miles away. I think most Americans now realize that Donald Trump is bigging up this war in the Middle East, the potential for a war, in order to really distract attention from the failings in his own domestic policy. So that's one of the horrible things that we in the world have to live with, is that a lot of what happens in the world is defined by whatever's going on in domestic policies in the United States.
Tony, I didn't mean to cut you off, but we're over a minute over time. I want to thank both you gentlemen for joining us. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist out of Bristol and Said. I want to apologize. I knew you wanted to get your last two cents in. We'll have to continue at some other time. Said Mohsen Abbas, political commentator, joining us from London. Thank you both. And viewers, we'll be right back with this extended coverage on the assassination of Iran's Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
Thank you.